Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 310, Side B. It's titled Bush League, and the reference, of course, is to the milieu and machinations of the administration of George W., in many ways, yet another administration run by his father, George I. We concluded Side A with discussion of the prominent role played by Roger Ailes. Actually, he's the head of Fox News Corporation, and Roger Ailes was a top campaign official with the elder George Bush, also was deeply involved with Rush Limbaugh's program for many years, and one of the things that, I should also not lose sight of the fact that the head of the political desk at Fox News was John Ellis, George W. and Jeb's cousin. He was the fellow who reversed the call of Florida from Al Gore to George Bush, thereby leading the media stampede that helped to, that was an inextricably, was a vital element in the crunching of Florida for George W. Bush. One of the things that's increasingly difficult and, from a very literal standpoint, subversive of American democracy is the limiting of the American media and the cozying up of the American media to the administration of George W. and or people connected with it. This is one of the reasons why I don't think we're receiving the objective coverage that we should be getting of George W.'s administration. This is not, sadly, a new phenomenon. Our media coverage has been inadequate of a great many things for a long time, but it's one of the things that I think has been helping George W. escape a lot of the flack that would be coming his way, and I think there's a lot more flack that would be coming his way than he will ever likely see. I also think we should not lose sight of the extent to which the media coverage of Bill Clinton's administration, for all of Bill Clinton's shortcomings, was horrendously slanted, and it affected, to a large extent, the public perception of Bill Clinton. One of the difficulties in assessing Bill Clinton is that his critics, in my opinion, on both the right and the left, themselves have no credibility, and to an enormous extent, a lot of institutionalized lies that were kicked around by the media came to be accepted as truth. I don't think most people, even today, including most astute people, realize how much of the BS that was kicked around about Bill Clinton, again, for all of his shortcomings, turned out to be nothing more than fabrication and propaganda. Filegate, nothing. Travelgate, nothing. Whitewater, $52 million, and 6 years later they came up with a BJ, which isn't a crime as long as it's between consenting adults, and that's basically all they came up with. People who say there are no significant differences between Democrats and Republicans are simply unaware. That's a politically illiterate statement. If George W. had been having an extramarital affair, the person in all likelihood would have been below the age of consent, probably would not have been a member of the opposite sex, probably wouldn't even have been, still been alive. But then Monica Lewinsky, for all of her shortcomings, was over the age of consent, was a member of the opposite sex, and was still alive when she had sex with Bill Clinton. That's one of the differences between the Republicans and the Democrats. By the way, this is obviously an attempt at humor on my part. People should not get too bent out of shape about that. Certainly should not be should not mistake that for homophobia in any way. But it's very interesting to me to see what W and company are getting away with, and to reflect on just what the coverage would be if Bill Clinton had been doing similar things. In For the Record program number 249, I discuss the very credible evidence that Prescott Bush Sr., George W.'s grandfather, as a member of Skull and Bones, had robbed Geronimo's grave and brought the remains of Geronimo, the famed Apache warrior, back to the Skull and Bones headquarters at Yale University. The San Carlos Apache have been deeply involved in an investigation of that and in an attempt to get Geronimo's remains to be returned to Oklahoma, Fort Sill, Oklahoma, where he was buried. That has been unsuccessful, and it's interesting to reflect just what we'd be hearing about Bill Clinton if his grandfather had been credibly established as having robbed Geronimo's grave. Consider the following, and bear in mind that both Georges Bush as well as Prescott Bush were members of the elite Skull and Bones fraternity at Yale. Skull and Bones itself is one of a number of institutions which which serves as sort of an old boy power network within the Eastern establishment in this country. And exactly what goes on behind closed doors at Skull and Bones has been a matter of conjecture for some time. Recently, a journalist named Ron Rosenbaum was able to get a videotape of the Skull and Bones initiation ceremony, and it proved very, very interesting indeed. It'd be interesting to reflect, imagine if this had been Bill Clinton, if this society had been one to which Bill Clinton belonged, and if the videotape of the initiation ceremony had come out, and imagine what Roger Ailes, Rush Limbaugh, and company would do with this if this was Bill Clinton's fraternity instead of the organization to which George's Bush belonged. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience. This is from the New York Observer. And this is an article, specifically the New York Observer, of Thursday, April 19th of the year 2001. This is an article by Ron Rosenbaum. It's headlined, "At Skull and Bones, Bush's Secret Club Initiates Ream Gore." And this column was run on page 1 in the New York Observer of April 23rd of the year 2001. And it's available on the New York Observer's website. It's copyright 2001 by the New York Observer. And again, the author is Ron Rosenbaum. The article reads in part as follows. Now, just imagine if Bill Clinton had been an alumnus of this organization instead of George W. Bush. Can you imagine the firestorm you'd be hearing? This article reads in part as follows. "It's the primal scene of American power, of Bush family values. For two centuries, the initiation rite of Skull and Bones has shaped the character of the men who have shaped the American character, including two presidents named Bush. And last Saturday, April 14th, for the first time ever, that long secret rite was witnessed by a team of outsiders, including this writer. Using high-tech night vision video equipment able to peer through the gloom into the inner courtyard of the Skull and Bones tomb in New Haven, the Observer team witnessed the George W. effect. Intoxicated by renewed proximity to presidential power, a robed bonesman posing as George W. harangued initiates in an eerily accurate Texas drawl, quote, 'I'm gonna ream you like I reamed Al Gore,' unquote, and 'I'm gonna kill you like I killed Al Gore,' unquote. Privileged Skull and Bones members mocked the assault on Abner Louima by crying out repeatedly, 'Take that plunger out of my A blank blank,' unquote. Skull and Bones members hurled obscene sexual insults, 'Lick my expletive deleted hole,' at initiates as they were forced to kneel and kiss a skull at the feet of the initiators. Other members acted out the tableau of a throat-cutting ritual murder. It's important to remember this is not some fraternity initiation. It is an initiation far more secret and far more significant in terms of real power in the United States than that of the Cosa Nostra. If the Bushes are the wasp Corleones, as the ever more stingingly waspish Maureen Dowd of the New York Times has suggested, this is how their made men and women are made. It's an initiation ceremony that has bonded diplomats, media moguls, bankers, and spies into a lifelong, multi-generational fellowship far more influential than any fraternity. It was, and still remains, the heart of the American establishment." Further revelations turned up by the Observer Bones Investigation Unit include the words to the secret Skull and Bones death mantra, copies of the Skull and Bones tax returns obtained through Freedom of Information Act requests raise questions about the legitimacy of the secret society's claim to charitable tax-exempt deduction status, particularly relevant considering recent criticism of the Bush tax plan for favoring the privileged few. A possible explanation emerged in the course of the initiation ceremony for George W.'s decision to run for the president in the first place. And by the way, there's a discussion of Skull and Bones and its role as sort of a nexus of the American power elite in the aforementioned For the Record program number 249, that available from Spitfire. Skipping down in this story, "The whole phenomenon is rarely looked into beyond the exotic ritual trappings, although Evan Thomas and Walter Isaacson talk about the worldwide web of Bones foreign policy mandarins in The Wise Men. This, by the way, is Ron Rosenbaum writing here, but it's something I've been investigating off and on for a quarter of a century now. I am the Ahab of Skull and Bones, pursuing the white whale, or white male leviathan to the utmost depths. As an undergraduate at Yale, I lived next door to the Skull and Bones tomb, and back in 1977, I published the first outsider's investigation into Skull and Bones, its rituals, and its influence on American political culture. An updated version of that piece, revised to include my chilly exchange with George and Barbara Bush on Air Force Two, can be found in my recent nonfiction collection, The Secret Parts of Fortune. By the way, there was also an account of that encounter in a New York Observer article from the year 2000 that is excerpted in the aforementioned For the Record 249. Continuing. And so it was momentous for me to actually hear the sounds of the Skull and Bones initiation on that laptop. But in listening to it, awe gave way to a mixture of puzzlement and embarrassment and an even deeper, unsatisfied curiosity. In part, it was the fact that the ritual was heard but not seen. My Yale source had found a previously unexploited perch from which to record the sounds of the ceremonies, but could glimpse them only incompletely. He reported a figure dressed like the devil, another one in a hooded skeleton costume, and others in robes. The thing that stood out for me listening to it was what I've come to think of as the death mantra, unquote. Yes, the death mantra, yes, the death mantra. Here it is, the three-line Skull and Bones initiation ritual theme that has bound three presidents, including the present one, to their secret society. The hangman equals death. The devil equals death. Death equals death. And Rosenbaum continues, most of the speculative lore about the Skull and Bones ritual has centered on its death fixation. Beyond the most obvious Skull and Bones, Skull and Crossbones insignia, of course, the most persistent story is that initiates spend their senior year in the basement crypt of the Bones tomb, taking turns lying in a coffin, and in two long, intense, psychodrama autobiographical sessions in said coffins, recount their personal and sexual history to the other 14 chosen ones. The better to bond for life with those they know best, and prepare for their destiny as stewards of the ruling class. The death-centered imagery, the injunction to initiates that they must die to the barbarian world, unquote, and be reborn in the Elysian company of the elect of the order, as they call it, is what makes Skull and Bones as radically different from a college fraternity as the Gambino family is from the hunting and fishing club, unquote, that was their nominal headquarters. The hangman equals death. The devil equals death. Death equals death. What the hell is going on there? Is it a puzzle in logic like all men are mortal, Socrates is mortal? Does it solve out to the hangman equals the devil? And skipping down still further, of the actual initiation ceremony itself, Rosenbaum writes, from my post, I could see through an open window shadowy figures walking very close above my head. Later, I'll put my audio impressions together with the video cam record the other team obtained for a more complete picture, but first, let me transcribe some of the notes I made from listening in. Fragmentary as they are, they capture some of the strangeness and perhaps the kind of disorientation the initiates themselves experienced there in the courtyard of Skull and Bones. First, there was the guy posing as George W. He seemed to be a bit disgruntled at being given this role, a feeling he expressed by calling out in his George W. drawl to another patriarch, as they're called, I got the power to bomb the expletive deleted out of China, and they give me this station, unquote. Then someone, one of the initiates, called out Uncle Toby. Many bone ritual personae are taken from Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy. You gotta give them credit there for good taste. Uncle Toby, the cry repeated. Shut up, neophyte. Take that plunger out of my expletive deleted, Uncle Toby. Presumably this mocking Louima reference was a ploy to scare initiates into thinking Uncle Toby was going to give them the plunger treatment. That cheerful rectal theme was followed up by, I'm going to ream you like I reamed Al Gore, from the George W. imitator, followed by, help me, it's the devil. And then, George W., really getting into it, I'm gonna kill you like I killed Al Gore. Silence. Then a door opened. Voices, half of them it seemed women, were screaming, "Run, neophyte! Run, neophyte!" The neophytes are, of course, the new initiates. From my post, I could see only hooded figures racing about in the darkness above my head, accompanied by cries of, "Run, neophyte! Find the femur!" And again, "Take that plunger out of my expletive deleted, Uncle Toby," unquote. Then, silence for a while. The neophyte seemed to have gone back inside the tomb, after which one of the patriarchs complained, quote, "We ought to get better blood than this effin' syrup, man," unquote. It was only later that I learned what the blood was for the whole throat-slitting barbarian to blow after the skull-kissing. But first, there was a different kind of kissing being referred to. There were cries of, "Lick my expletive-deleted hole, neophyte! Lick my expletive-deleted, neophyte! Do you like my expletive-deleted, neophyte?" Despite these heartfelt pleas, we did not witness any of those acts being consummated. By the way, obviously I'm editing this for the purposes of radio. The expletive-deleted hole tribute was followed by more cries of, "Get the femur!" And at least part of the death mantra I'd heard before, "Death equals death." Following which, George W. chimed in with, "I'm the president of the mother effin' USA," apparently just for the sheer pleasure of saying it. He was sounding more like the real George W. all the time. It began to be clear that what was going on outside in the courtyard was the climax of an initiation ceremony that had begun inside the tomb. There, it's reputed, the initiates must first enter into a coffin and die to the barbarian world, unquote, to the world of savages, unquote. All but the skull and bones elect in order to be reborn as a member of the order, unquote. Then comes the skull kissing and the throat slashing. 2 hours later, after all 15 of the initiates had burst out to be harangued and scared, I approached the rendezvous point with the night vision camera team. This was the moment of truth. The night vision team wasn't sure what their digicams had picked up. With their own eyes, they'd gotten evocative glimpses, but the playback on the camera's swing-out view screens would be the first time, so far as we knew, any outsider had really seen the legendary ritual. A ritual 3 presidents, a few Supreme Court justices, maybe a dozen senators, including 2004 Democratic presidential contender John Kerry, which would mean a head-to-head, skull-to-skull smackdown with George W., several secretaries of state, literary and cultural luminaries including John Hersey, and William F. Buckley had all undergone. The footage was ghostly, it was grainy, but from the angles of the night vision cams, we were able to piece together a narrative of what happened when the initiates emerged one at a time from the preliminaries inside the tomb. First, they were led forward by a figure in a devil costume. Not really a sinister, satanic-looking figure, but as one of the team put it, more like Satan's little helper, unquote. A shrill, menacing, and sometimes blood-curdling chorus of cries and screams and imprecations accompanied the emergence. "Hurry, neophyte! Run, neophyte! Find the femur, neophyte!" Along with the occasional, "Lick my expletive-deleted hole, remove the plunger," type outcries. The devil figure pulled them into a white tent in the courtyard, where we think they found their femurs and emerged with what looked like a thigh bone, although it was impossible to tell whether it once belonged to a human or not. When they emerged from the tent, they were led to the centerpiece of this part of the ritual. They were forced face to face with a shocking tableau. A guy holding what seemed like a butcher knife, wearing a kind of animal skin barbarian look, stood over what seemed to be a woman covered in fake blood and not much else. The neophyte then approached a skull a few feet away from the knife-wielder and victim tableau. The neophyte knelt and kissed the skull, at which point the guy with the knife knelt and cut the throat of the prone figure. Well, pretended to cut the throat. I'm not sure what it all means. I've yet to decode the mystical significance of this, although I do love to think of former President George Bush kissing the skull. Obviously, it has something to do with subservience. Kiss the skull of power. Bow down to the order. But what about the barbarian cutting the throat of his victim? Unquote. Well, indeed. What about that? Remains to be seen, and exactly what goes on behind closed doors at the Skull and Bones is also a matter of conjecture. Again, there's discussion of Skull and Bones, some of the avenues of power that go through that institution, including those leading in the direction of the intelligence community and international fascism, and also the San Carlos Apaches investigation into Prescott Bush Sr.'s alleged robbing of Geronimo's grave. That, again, in For the Record program number 249. Just imagine if Bill Clinton had been a member of Skull and Bones. Can you imagine what Roger Ailes and company would be doing with that? I don't think it would be as relatively, the furor surrounding that would be as relatively quiet as it has been. Consider also if Bill Clinton had been the person to be associated with a fellow named Enrique Fuentes León. This is somebody we spoke about at considerable length in For the Record program number 281. That broadcast is entitled Los Amigos de Bush, and it deals with some of the Mexican-American associates of George W., their connections to the drug trade, their involvement with the energy business, both in Mexico and the United States, and also some very, very unsavory extracurricular activities that this milieu has been adjacent to and or involved with. Fuentes León's name came up in connection with one of the least appetizing crimes, and that's maybe will sound sort of silly, that I've read about in a long time. This was discussed in the New York Times of Friday, June 22nd of the year 2001. This is an article by Tim Weiner, W-E-I-N-E-R, at Stateline, Mexico City, June 21st, and headlined, U.S. Returns an Ex-Judge to Mexico. Subtitled, A 12-Year Fugitive in a Bribery Case, and it reads in part as follows. The case against Ernesto Diaz, a judge-turned-fugitive, stands out even in Mexico, a nation weary of official corruption and impunity. Mr. Diaz was a justice minister appointed by the Supreme Court as its liaison aide with the nation's federal judges. Then, in 1988, a prominent criminal defense lawyer, Enrique Fuentes León, handed him a honey-colored briefcase that held $500,000, according to the Attorney General's office. Two untoward events ensued. Mr. Fuentes's client, a rich man from Acapulco, Alejandro Braun Diaz, had been convicted of kidnapping, torturing, raping, and murdering a six-year-old, was suddenly set free from prison after having served 2 years of a 30-year sentence. And Mr. Diaz and Mr. Fuentes disappeared. On Tuesday, after more than 12 years as a fugitive, Mr. Diaz, now 70, was arrested in San Antonio, Texas, where he had lived since at least 1993. He was promptly deported to Mexico, where he faces bribery and corruption charges. And for the aforementioned For the Record program number 281, we dealt with this particular case, and specifically we took a look at the connections between Los Amigos de Bush, including Enrique Fuentes León, the lawyer alluded to there, and George W. Bush. This milieu is inextricably linked with the drug trade, the energy business in Mexico, and George W. Bush is very, very close politically to this particular milieu. I'm going to reprise a couple of short sections of the article that we used for the record program number 281. Again, Los Amigos de Bush. This article was researched for us by a member of the listening audience. This is from El Andar magazine. That's capital E-L, capital A-N-D-A-R. This is by Julie Reynolds with research assistance from Victor Almazan and Ana Leonor Rojo. It's entitled Los Amigos de Bush, The Shady Ties of George W. Bush's Latino Friends. It's from El Andar's issue of Fall of 2000, Volume 11, Number 3. And you can visit El Andar's website at www.elandar.com for discussion of this excellent article, or for examination, I should say, of this excellent article. Now, bear in mind that Enrique Fuentes León was part of this circle of Los Amigos de Bush. This milieu, again, discussed in For the Record program 281, is inextricably linked with the drug trade. And we're going to take a look at a couple of unsavory cases here. Again, the murder and the rape, torture, and murder of that six-year-old girl. And also another case that Los Amigos de Bush helped to represent in court. One of the legal associates of Enrique Fuentes León was a Texas-based narco lawyer named Roy Barrera Jr. Barrera Jr., along with his father, are two of the top narco attorneys in the state of Texas. Barrera Jr. drove a mobile home across the state of Texas with Barbara Bush as part of the elder George Bush's 1992 presidential campaign. Of the connections between Enrique Fuentes León, the torture, rape, and murder of that six-year-old girl, and George W., we read as follows from Los Amigos to Bush. Speaking of the Dominion, a very pricey real estate development in San Antonio, but by far the biggest piece of acreage in Dominion was bought by Enrique Fuentes León, a fugitive sought in Mexico for bribing judges on behalf of a rich Acapulco playboy who raped, tortured, and killed a six-year-old girl. Fuentes León fled to Chile, then to Argentina. Then he arrived in Texas with a visa that said he was an investor. Skipping down. With his visa about to expire, Fuentes León made fruitless pleas to America's high and mighty, including George W. Bush, who called his father the president on Fuentes León's behalf. Fuentes León was finally arrested, and attempted bribery and drug money laundering charges were ready to be filed against him, too. The Barreras took the case, and later on in the article it discusses Fuentes León's connections to the murder of Donaldo Colosio and to José Ruiz Maceo, both of them prominent Mexican politicians, and also links Fuentes León and the other members of Los Amigos de Bush to drug trafficking and a number of other unsavory activities as well. Now, again, one of the close associates of Fuentes León was the aforementioned Roy Barrera Jr., again, a close political associate of both George's Bush, and a fellow who drove a mobile home across the state of Texas with Barbara Bush as part of the elder George W.'s failed 1992 campaign. Barrera Jr. is, like Enrique Fuentes León, an exponent of family values, as exemplified by the following case, turning once again to Los Amigos de Bush. Last year, Barrera Jr. landed in the hot seat. He represented millionaire Alan Blackthorne after the contract-style murder of Blackthorne's ex-wife, Sheila Bellish, B-E-L-L-U-S-H. The case made national headlines because Bellish was stabbed to death in front of her toddler quadruplets, and they crawled around in her blood until they were found. The hitman, Jose Del Toro, fled to Mexico and was represented by none other than Barrera's old Gulf cartel client, the prestigious office of Enrique Fuentes León. Just imagine, again, if this had been Los Amigos de Clinton instead of Los Amigos de Bush, can you imagine what Roger Ailes and company would be doing with this story? Just give that one some thought. I've alluded to other broadcasts that I've covered over the years, and by the way, we'll be going into George Bush and the energy business and many, many other aspects of the Bush League, as I call it, in future broadcasts. I've alluded to other programs that I've produced over the years. Those are available from a tape and duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179. That's P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. There's a list of and description of the various programs available from Spitfire, including detailed and annotated descriptions of the For the Record programs on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. The For the Record programs obviously are in the For the Record section. By the way, the Spitfire website is equipped with real audio, and listeners can hear the two programs going out to the various stations that carry the broadcast the week that they are going out. Sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is archiving the For the Record programs on real audio. Those are available on two websites. Relatively recent For the Record programs are streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emery, DaveEmory. There's another website with older and more numerous For the Record programs available for downloading, although they're not streaming. That website is at http://archive.wfmu.org/archive/D X/. Listeners can listen to the three-hour program that I do on KFJC-FM in the South San Francisco Bay Area from 7 to 10 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday at kfjc.org. Look in the Transmissions and Public Affairs section. That concludes Side B of For the Record Program 310, Bush League. This is being recorded on July 8th of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.